Blog Talk Radio.
On the incredible wake up music of Stryper on The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. Good morning to you. My name is Randy L. Noble. I am your host, as always. And yes, truth is marching on. Right in front of me, I have a copy of my latest book, The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. This came out and it was made available back in November of last year. It's been doing quite well, very well received among many people that are being made aware of just the plight for freedom in Iran, just the oppression, the difficult life between the Iron Curtain of the Islamic Republic and Iran. And today we are focusing in once again on my Iranian friends' plight for freedom. Freedom is what they thirst and hunger for. And in order to really bring you to the point of where you actually see and feel and hear their fight for freedom, I have a very special movie we're going to talk about today. It's called Desert Dancer. It's the story. It's an autobiographical story in a sense, but it's biographical. It's about Afshan Garafian, who is a dancer in Iran. And of course, in Iran, everything good and fun is banned by the Islamic Republic, and of course, dancing is banned. If you remember about a year ago, when some Iranians got together and made a video from the song Happy, and it was an amazing song. They got up on the rooftops of Tehran and danced to this song called Happy, and made a video called Happy in Tehran, and they were arrested by the regime and actually made to publicly recant for making this video. Well, of course, that involved dancing, men with women dancing to a video, a very happy, very motivational song by Pharrell Williams. And of course, the regime would not stand for that. Well, in like manner, this movie I'm going to talk about today, Desert Dancer, is about the story of Afshan Garafian, who during the presidential election of 2009 cast his vote for the Green Movement. He wore a little wristband, and he was teaching dancing underground dancing because it's forbidden in Iran. And when pressure got too great, he had to flee to France. Well, this movie is actually out in the theaters here where I live in the United States, but unfortunately it's not being shown in my state. It has limited screening. And the actual DVD of the movie won't be available until the summer, so I have not had an opportunity to actually sit and watch this. I've only seen outtakes and trailers, but it looks fantastic. Freedom of expression is banned in Iran. We're going to find out more about this incredible movie and about dancing and about one man's fight for the freedom of expression. Just, he's one among millions of Iranians standing up for his right to express himself and having to fight for it because Iran hates anything Western, anything that has freedom of expression is against their Sharia law. Very, very sad. In the last couple of weeks, executions have spiked. Unbelievable execution frenzy going on in Iran. In fact, about 65 people, 65 prisoners, political prisoners, were executed just last week, and 200 more are scheduled. And part of these executions are taking place in the prison where Saeed is presently sitting in and languishing in. And, of course, this has had a real psychological effect on Saeed, and I actually talked about this a few programs ago and how Nagme said that when her father-in-law would go visit him, and Saeed's father, he could tell just the anguish he's going through because of the executions that are going on all around him as the regime is involved in another execution frenzy there in Iran. It's very, very sad. But also what's going on with Saeed is he's being threatened because the regime hates the message of Christ, and they don't like what he's doing in prison by sharing the hope that is found in Jesus. And they have threatened to never let him out of this prison. And unless he recants and comes back to Islam, he will be there the rest of his life. Well, what I want to do this morning, I want to play this special report by the Christian Broadcasting Network, CBN, who just recently talked about this issue. It's called Recant or Else, Saeed's Dilemma. We're going to listen to this special report right now on the cross in the desert.
Gordon, prison guards in Iran are threatening American pastor Saeed Abedini, deny Christ and become a Muslim, or you will never be free. George Thomas has that story.
Saeed Abedini was convicted on January 27, 2013, and condemned to 8 years in prison. Now Iranian authorities are threatening to extend that prison sentence, something his lawyers say has been done to other Christian prisoners in the past.
They find some other way to set them up for a falsehood and try them for an additional conviction.
According to Abedini's wife, Nagme, prison guards have become increasingly hostile, reportedly tormenting the 35-year-old American pastor with constant psychological threats. In a Facebook post, Nagme writes, he has been under a lot of pressure and attack from the hardliners. The guards have also been threatening Saeed that he will never go free. They continually threaten Saeed that the only key to his freedom is denying Christ and returning to Islam. Abedini is serving his sentence in one of the toughest prisons in Iran.
This is a prison that was built for 5,000 individuals, currently housing over 20,000. So you've got incredible hygienic conditions. You've got threats from other cellmates. Certainly several of them see him as a threat right now as Iran and the United States are negotiating this nuclear deal.
Nagme says recent prisoner executions have also taken their toll on her husband. Despite the hardships, she writes that he continues to remain strong in the faith. He wants you all to know that the Lord continues to move in that prison and lives are being transformed. They had a great Easter in prison. Saeed desperately missed being with our family on Easter, but new Easter traditions were created in prison. Over the years, this journey has truly become more difficult and painful for Saeed and for the kids and I. Our family appreciates your continued prayers. George Thomas, CBN News.
In that particular interview you heard there by CBN, you heard the voice of Tiffany Barons, which is one of the lawyers representing Nagme. When Nagme has been on my radio program, Tiffany has also been there as a guest, but she's there for a reason. She has to be wherever Nagme really speaks, to be there for any legal reasons. Just recently, I came across this incredible documentary film produced by the American Center for Law and Justice, and it's aptly called Let My People Go. That's a quote that Moses said to the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus, warning Pharaoh there would be consequences if he didn't let the people of God, the Hebrew children, free from slavery to return to the country of Israel, a land of milk and honey, to worship God. He was threatening Pharaoh with consequences. He said, "Let my people go." And this is a very famous line in the book of Exodus, which is also the title of the new documentary film put out by the American Center for Law and Justice. It's a film showing the intense persecution of the global Christian church, and it features interviews with Nagme Abedini, Andrew White, which is a pastor in Iraq, dealing with a harsh situation there with ISIS, and several other people. I think Jay Sekulow, of course, is in it. Jordan, his brother, is also in the film. But this is a very intense, well-put-together documentary that takes you behind the scenes of the American Center of Law and Justice and how they represent their clients, the different situations with the family going through the intense psychological emotion of having a loved one in prison in a foreign country in the Middle East, and how they deal with the situations. Plus, it's a documentary of the suffering global Christian church, that there is a plan by the enemy to destroy the church. And I'm thinking of what Jesus said to Peter when Peter confessed that you are the Christ. He says, upon this confession, upon this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. It's a promise that the church will always remain strong, that death itself can't separate Christians from God, that he is their rock. The church is built on this confession that Jesus is the Christ, and the church will endure every intense and persecution. It will never be destroyed. The promise of Christ is it will never go astray. It will never apostatize. It's built on the solid rock of who Jesus is. It's his church that has endured hardship and persecution since the day of Pentecost. And so we think about this promise of Christ, and then we hear about what happens in the Middle East with ISIS, and we think, how much can the Christian church take? And Jesus says, the gates of hell will not prevail against my church. He is with his church. You see that imagery in the book of Revelation chapter 1, where Jesus is standing in the midst of the churches of intense persecution during the first century under Domitian, the Roman emperor. So as we look in history and we look in scripture, we know the church will continue, will prevail, can never be destroyed. The gates of hell cannot overwhelm the church. What I want to do now, since we talked about Saeed's dilemma this morning, I want to take his behind the scenes in one of the parts of the film that features the situation with Saeed, and you will hear some things maybe you've never heard before, special little insights and interviews with Nagme. This is from the ACLJ feature film Let My People Go, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Saeed became a believer in 2000. Soon after that, he started house churches, underground churches. He was arrested by the intelligence police, and he was told as long as he discontinued any house church movement, that they would allow him to freely move back and forth into Iran, see his family, his parents, his siblings. And one of the intelligence police even suggested, why don't you do humanitarian efforts? So when he came back in 2009, we were praying, and we both had a huge heart for the orphans. The government actually gave us approval. Between 2009 and 2012, Saeed traveled into Iran more than 9 times. He followed all the guidelines he was given by the government. Unfortunately, he was stopped. His passport was taken as he was leaving to come back to the U.S. He was under house arrest for 2 months. From July to September, and in September of 2012, the house was raided, his parents' house that he was staying at in Iran, and he was taken by Revolutionary Guards. I got in touch with the State Department immediately. It was the hardest phone call of my life, because I expected something, and they said, there's nothing we can do.
Saeed had traveled back and forth to Iran several times since 2009, and this was the first instance where, before he left, he said, Naghmi, should anything happen to me, I want you to reach out to this news reporter who he had connected to via Facebook. She'll know what to do. Lisa Zaftari, who's been great on Saeed's case, called my cell phone and said, Tiffany, I don't know who else to give this client to you except for the ACLJ. Would you be willing to talk to her?
So I immediately called and said, this is what's happened. We don't know where he is.
We're on the phone with Naghmi Abedini, his wife, here in the United States. We started working on his situation within 24 hours of his arrest. By the time Saeed was returned home and put under house arrest, we represented Saeed internationally.
From that moment, of course, it's a highly intense situation. We step in both as advocates, somebody who can step in, removed from the emotion, to be able to provide objectivity to what is a situation that's very hard to have clarity in when it's one of your family members who's been taken or missing. It was also her Christian counselor who sat and prayed with her through a very difficult time.
I don't know if people realize how crucial ACLJ was in our life. I believe it was God's provision that ACLJ had already dealt with legal issues in Iran. They already knew a lot of the legal system, they were very familiar with the Iranian system, the court.
Saeed Abedini's case was not the first case, not the first apostasy case, not the first death penalty case we handled. We handled a case for another Iranian, Yousef Nardarkhani.
Pastor Yousef Nardarkhani is an Iranian Christian pastor, and he was in prison because of his work as a Christian, the house churches that these Christians are involved in. And it's questionable, even under Iranian law, if that's even illegal. There are a number of Christians imprisoned in Iran only because of their faith. They came to us because he was in a dire situation. They're not attorneys. So a smaller ministry said, can you help? Can you do something? He's on death row. He's been given a death sentence, so not just a prison sentence, but a death sentence. Is there anything you can do? And so we launched an international campaign.
A Christian pastor in Iran imprisoned for nearly 3 years, facing a death sentence because of his Christian faith. July 8, 2012, marked the 1,000th day of captivity for Christian pastor Yousef Nardarkhani, facing execution for simply becoming a Christian. When Iranian officials demanded that he recant his faith in Jesus Christ or die, he responded with two words, I cannot. It is vital to keep Pastor Yousef in the spotlight and the pressure on Iran. At the American Center for Law and Justice, we are doing all that we can in this country and abroad to secure his freedom. Our Tweet for Yousef campaign reaches more than 2.2 million Twitter accounts daily, spanning the globe, connecting 200 countries around the world, calling attention to the plight of Pastor Yousef. We also know the importance of the power of prayer, and so does Pastor Yousef. In a letter he released from prison not long ago, he specifically thanked everyone who has, quote, asked for my release or campaigns and human rights activities which are going on against the charges which are applied to me, end quote. He also had one simple request. Pray for me, he wrote. Please continue to pray for Pastor Yousef and all those who face persecution because of their Christian faith.
When the regime gets more radical, as it was under Pastor Yousef Nardarkhani when he was in prison, they not only put him in jail or in prison, but they sentenced him to death. And they charged him with also being an apostate. That means someone who left Islam. So he was a Muslim and he converted to Christianity. In his trial, his death penalty trial, this is how much it is about religion and nothing else, and about faith and nothing else. They gave him three opportunities to renounce his faith, and he would have walked out. So not only would he have not faced the death penalty, he would have walked out of prison. And the court case would have been over if he would have just said, I don't believe in Christ, I'm now a Muslim, gone through the Muslim prayer, and that would be it.
I well remember this case. I remember tweeting for Pastor Yousef. I remember posting many things on my Facebook page. I wrote blogs about Pastor Yousef. And I was just thrilled. I think it was September 2012 when he was finally released. It was just an amazing day for all of us. We are so grateful for the hard work of many, many people who prayed. And, of course, the ACLJ, who was behind this case almost from the very beginning. We feel the same way here on the Cross in the Desert, that there will be a day when all of us can rejoice, like with Pastor Yousef, that Saeed is finally free. and we can rejoice and know that our God is on our side, that he is working behind the scenes, even when we don't think he is. Our sovereign God is doing amazing things. And so there is coming a day, I believe, that all of us will be filled with inexpressible joy and celebration when we hear that Saeed has finally been freed from prison in Iran. This, of course, you're listening to the special documentary film by the ACLJ, Let My People Go. Last week, I had a very special guest on the Cross in the Desert, Naureen Anweya. She's an Assyrian Christian activist, a human rights activist, a very powerful voice for the Assyrian Christians in Iraq. And we had a lengthy interview talking about the genocide that's happening there, the near extermination and displacement of the Assyrian Christians. And she laid out a very, very, very powerful, all of us should be involved in some way of being a voice for these Assyrian Christians. Well, also on this documentary film, there is a man called Andrew White, who is actually a pastor in Iraq, and he deals with the Assyrian Christians. And on this second segment I'm going to play for you, we're going to go into Iraq now and feel the pain and the torture and the dilemma of the Assyrian Christians. And let's listen to it right now from the ACLJ documentary film, Let My People Go, right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Well, we're seeing a rise of Islamic extremism. This is not only happening in Iraq, but also in Pakistan, Sudan, northern Nigeria, Somalia.
The entire church communities, Christian communities, wiped out in places like Syria and Iraq. Where that's our history. That's our heritage. Those are the places we point to as the birthplace of Christianity as we know it. And they want to eradicate our history there. So they want to not just kill the people, they want to destroy the buildings.
You see that right now in the Middle East, especially in the Middle East, but also in Africa, northern Africa particularly, where people are literally being hung because of their faith. And of course, if you take a situation with a group like ISIS, being beheaded, crucified, simply because they're Christians and will not forcibly be converted to another religion, in that particular case, Islam.
The situation in Iraq, this is one of the most robust Christian communities left in the Middle East. They fled because they were targeted by various jihadi groups.
There are more Iraqi Christians now in Chicago than there are in the whole of Iraq.
ISIS's purpose is to establish a global caliphate, putting everyone under Sharia Islamic law, with no exceptions.
You would think that 1,400 years that this would have been, you know, gone, long gone, but it's coming back, and it's coming back with vengeance, with far less even mercy than those original Islamist invaders.
We're seeing it now more than we ever saw before.
We're going through a period of a great wave of persecution. In fact, Pope Francis has said recently that there's more persecution today than there was in the first century of Rome.
The Islamic recruiters for Al-Qaeda-tied groups like Al-Shabaab, they're going into the slums, into the poor neighborhoods of Nairobi and other major cities in Kenya. And they're offering up jobs. They're saying it's job training. And these are people that don't have a lot of future, that don't necessarily have a lot going for them in life, and then ultimately they end up at a terrorist training camp where they're indoctrinated.
There's no reasoning. They do not understand reasoning. They think Allah said it, and therefore we are his emissaries, and we've got to do it.
Allah qawiyun aziz wa mujaladati a'da'illah wa waffaqahum wa makkanahum li tahqiq ghayatihim.
If you see the brutality that is engaged in by ISIS, what is the commonality with all of these regimes? They really target Christians.
For the first time, there will be no, since Christianity, there will be no Christmas in 2014 in the entire area of Nineveh, because ISIS has driven out every last Christian and closed every last church.
Thousands of refugees who've had to flee Nineveh. They've got no homes. They live in churches on the floor. They live in plastic tents. They've got nothing.
Christians, at best, are treated like second-class citizens, or at worst, like in Iraq today and in Syria. No matter what they do, they cannot exist. Their churches cannot remain open. They must be killed or driven out.
What we have worked for and achieved is just being banished overnight.
The stories that we hear about here in the U.S. are the ones that are the most shocking and the most brutal, and the ones that really, they shock the conscience. You almost can't believe. It's not just a simple murder, if you put it that way, but it's done in such a barbaric way that we all take a step back and say, this is how poorly people view Christians. They don't value their life at all.
At the same time, there are Muslims who are wanting just to live a life. There are many of these people who are being annihilated as well. They are being killed in Mosul. They're being killed in these other cities because they won't join ISIS. They just want to live their life. And so they have been executed as well. So if there's Christians, no question, but there's also Muslims that are suffering too out of this.
They are saying this is not Islam. This is not what we stand for. And this is not what we have developed in our relationship together over the years. We love each other, we respect each other, and now there is nothing there but total isolation and destruction.
Not stopping ISIS is not an option. ISIS has to be crushed. They have to be completely eliminated. You have to defeat them militarily, you have to defeat them politically, you have to defeat them in the hearts and minds of Muslims, and that's a part of this process. It has to be eliminated.
A Muslim mob in Pakistan that's burning a couple alive in between two pieces of metal, and there's a crowd cheering that. I mean, you're talking about front lines of extremism where there are Christians being killed almost on a daily basis.
People are still getting killed. People are still getting tortured.
You've got a combination of lethality capability that previous generations that were on an Islamic conquest did not have, weaponry, sophistication, telecommunications, social media.
ISIS is serious about its business of mass destruction. And whether we are in Washington, New York, or London, we are all at risk.
Instead of dealing with slings and arrows, or even bullets, you could be dealing with a situation where you have weapons of mass destruction.
They have killed people. They have chopped their heads off. They have cut little children in half. It is so painful. These were people that we loved. These were our people. And they have gone.
There you hear the perplexed voice of Andrew White, one of the pastors there in Iraq. He has a very, very strong church congregation there, a light in the darkness. As I was going through my usual routine of seeing what's online on the internet, I came across this powerful video, and I wish I could actually play this for you. It's musical background with a message to ISIS from the people of the cross, and it is a message. It's so beautifully well done. I wish I could share this with you in a visual way. But it talks about Christians who will bear the stigma, the mark of the cross, without recanting. They will remain strong if they hold out their arms of love and forgiveness to even the most brutal of people belonging to ISIS. And in this visual plea from the people of the cross to ISIS, it shows the forgiveness of God through Christ to those in ISIS, even for the most brutal and horrible and unthinkable things they've done. The message is forgiveness. This is what Jesus taught. He says, love your enemies. Pray for them that persecute you. When we love our enemies, we are not condoning the things they are doing, the hate and the spew that they're spewing out of themselves. We are not condoning their sin. We're reaching out with the love of Christ and extending to them forgiveness, because in the end, love conquers hate. love conquers evil, and Jesus told us that this is the way we are to behave even to our enemies. And so in this beautiful 3-minute video of the letter of to ISIS from the people of the cross, it's just abusing. It's just a beautiful, beautiful video. And hopefully one day I can actually share this with you. It just brought me to tears to see how we as the body of Christ can embrace the hatred and evil in the world with love, and love does conquer evil. Jesus said it best in John chapter 10, verse 18, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." And this goes right along in Luke chapter 9, verse 23. If any of you wants to be my disciple, you must first take up your cross, first deny yourself, and take up your cross and follow me. And so Jesus is outlining the cost of being a disciple. He is telling his disciples here in John 15, understand the reason why they hate you. And he outlines the reasons. And we can see in Iraq and all over the world the words of Jesus coming true about how Christians are treated by those who hate him, those who hate God. And we're seeing that very, very graphically. It's 10 o'clock now on the Cross in the Desert. I want to take us now in a little bit of a different direction than what we've been talking about this morning. I came across this movie about a month ago and have been thinking of ways to share it with you. I want to talk to you about a new film that is now playing here, actually playing in Illinois, the state over from Missouri. It's playing in several other states, but not here in Missouri. And so in order for me to give you a real a description of the movie, I'll have to watch it. And it won't come out in DVD until sometime this summer. But I've looked behind the scenes, I've listened to interviews, and I'm very impressed with this movie. I'm talking about Desert Dancer. Desert Dancer is a 2014 biographical film directed by a man named Richard Raymond, actually his debut as a director of films like this. It tells the true story of a young, self-taught dancer in Iran. His name is Afshin Garafian, who risked his life for his dream to become a dancer despite a nationwide dancing ban. Of course, dancing is banned in Iran. The basic plot line is that the movie is set in Iran, and the story follows the ambition of Afshin Garafian. It takes place during the volatile climate of the 2009 presidential election. Afshin and some of his friends, including the lady he dances with, Elahi, risk their lives and form an underground dance company. The group learn dancing from videos by Michael Jackson, Gene Kelly, and Rudolf Nureyev, even though the online videos are banned. Now, Afshin and Eli also learned much from each other and learned how to embrace their passion for dance and for one another. Well, the best I can do for you right now, because the actual DVD is not out, is to play the trailer to give you a taste of what Desert Dancer it's all about. So let's listen to it right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Dancing class.
Dancing is forbidden.
But if you're going to do it, you do it somewhere safe.
Afshin, welcome to the Sava.
Our country is like two parallel worlds. There's the one you see outside. Yes! And there's this world behind closed doors. In here, we are free.
You know, guys, I've been thinking. I want to start a dance group.
Look, it's illegal. You get caught, you go to prison.
I want us to take control of our lives. You know, have somewhere that's ours, where we can create with no rules.
An underground dance company. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
So, this is a dance group.
If you want to be smart, maybe the last one should take the key with them.
Can I audition?
Anything. Waving goodbye or raising your fist in the air. But you only make a difference when you find your own secret language.
We should perform.
to an audience. We can go out to the desert. We can feel what it's like to breathe.
Who is Afshin Ghaffarian?
We will find you, Afshin Ghaffarian!
I'm in a lot of trouble.
Afshin, you can't stay here. They'll kill you.
Take my passport. It isn't me fit.
Go to Paris. And don't come back.
Don't ever get up. Don't let anyone stop you. Not even me.
My name is Afshin Ghaffarian. I'm a citizen of Iran. I'm a dancer.
A Desert Dancer, the story of Afshin Ghaffarian, who dares to take his freedom of expression literally, and he founds this underground dance group, but eventually is forced out of Iran into Paris, where he actually lives today. This was a remarkable film. The behind-the-scenes dancing sequences are just fantastic. Of course, Afshin learned from videos, looking at videos of Gene Kelly and Michael Jackson dancing, and so it's amazing how this man incorporated all of these different talents from American dancers like Gene Kelly and decided to, look, this is freedom of expression, and I am Iranian, and I'm going to defy the Iranian regime. I'm going to go public with this. But he knew he couldn't really do it very long, that the regime would find him, would arrest him, would put him away for the rest of his life. So in order to keep dancing, he took his good friend Elahi, and they fled to Paris. This is an amazing film, and it's actually now showing here in the United States. It premiered just last year in Germany on July 3rd, and then after that, subsequently in Italy on July 13th, and then in Hong Kong in August, and now it's here in the United States, and I can't wait to really see this film. The people that play in it, maybe not someone that you know of, but I think it's only proper to name who's in the film. Afshin is played by Rhys Ritchie. His friend Elahi is played by Frida Pinto, and his mother, Parisa Gafarin, is played by a lady named Nazanin Boniadi. What I want to do, in order to help us to understand the background for this film, to understand what went into to making it, I want to take us behind the scene and talk to a couple of people. The first person we're going to hear from is from Nazanin Boniadi, and she plays Afshin's mother in the film. And this is a little sound bite segment interview that will give you some insights about behind the scenes of the movie Desert Dancer, right here on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Desert Dancer is about a young Iranian man in Iran named Afshin Ghaffarian, who had a dream of becoming a dancer despite a nationwide ban on dancing, and the struggles he had to go through to reach his dream. The thing that I connected most with this film was the fact that it's the very first time that the Green Movement, the Green Revolution of 2009, is being depicted cinematically. It has never been put on the big screen. This film humanizes Iranians, Middle Easterners, for the first time, I think, in film, where you have these kids, and by the way, more than half of the Iranian population are under the age of 35. So these kids in Iran, these young adults, who have the same goals and hopes and aspirations as the rest of us, who love to dance, who fall in love like the rest of us, who may do drugs, who fall prey to the same afflictions and have the same problems that we do on a daily basis in America and England and everywhere across the world. And it humanizes Iranians. And I think the main thing that I take away from this film is, if we want to have world peace, if we want to have any kind of understanding of people who we don't know anything about, we have to focus on our similarities. And that's what this film does. It really shows the human side of Iran. It's not about the nuclear issue. It's not about the politics. It's about people. Early on, Richard and I had a discussion about Parisa being kind of the anchor, the person who starts off her son's journey. she gives her son the freedom to pursue his dreams. She encourages it. And I think there are a lot of parents like that in Iran who want their kids to fulfill their dreams and show them the right way. And as a woman, to have that power in the film, that strength, I think was very important. The thing that I love most about Richard's direction is that he asked a lot of questions. He did his own research, of course, but on set, he really would come to me with questions like, you know, is this hijab right? Is the headscarf right? You know, would women dress this way in Iran? Does this ring true? Do you think this is authentic? And I think he really paid special attention to authenticity. The Iranian people know the plight of the Iranian people. It's everybody else in the world that doesn't. So I completely understand and it's completely justified in my eyes that the film would be in English, which is a universal language. It's completely justified in my eyes that the cast would be a universal cast from all over the world, so that people across the world can connect to this story. Because, yes, it's based in Iran, but this could happen anywhere in the world. Repression is repression, injustice is injustice. And there's so many cases of injustice across the world that I think even if it's a personal case of injustice, people can relate to the story. It's about the freedom of expression. And it's such a basic human right that I think everybody can relate to the story. So I think it was important for the film to have this kind of universality, and I think Richard did a fantastic job with that. There's a history of repressing artists in Iran, actors like Mazia Bafomer, Pegah Ahangarani, who have been persecuted for expressing themselves. And at the core of this film, it's just about the freedom of expression and the right to freedom of expression, which I think most artists can relate with because we draw so heavily, we rely on it so heavily in our work. So, so all of those were sources of kind of research and inspiration for me. The way Akram Khan captured everything that's real about what's going on inside of Iran in dance was so impressive. You know, the fact that there's a moment where Frida and Reese are about to touch and then Tom, separates their hands with a movement. Because he represents the besieged. And it's just so powerful. And it just conjures up so many emotions when you're watching it. It's uplifting at the same time, it's inspiring. You want to make a difference at the end of this film. You want to do something, you want to get up and get involved in a way to make the world a better place, to follow your dreams, even if it's just something for you personally. I think the film ignites something in people. So there's a lot of passion, there's a lot of emotion at the end of this film.
A lot of passion, a lot of emotion in this film, a powerful film, which is a biographical sketch of Afshin Garafian, I'm going to stumble over his name, sorry about that, Garafian, who is a dancer. And the interview we just heard from was from Nazanin Boniadi, who plays his mother in the film, just describing the background, the culture, what was going on, why dancing was banned. And it's because Sharia law suppresses human creativity. There are filmmakers in Iran who are in prison, that are in exile because of not being able to express in film the emotions, the feelings of human beings. It's considered taboo, according to the Iranian regime. Anything human, it seems, the expression of humanity is banned in Iran. As we saw, I told you recently about the film, the video, Happy, the Happy Iranians, the Iranians that dance to a song by Will Ferrell, when were arrested and made to recant for making this little music video. So the continual fight for freedom of expression, it happens in Iran. But what this film does, it shows there are triumphs for causes, that freedom takes courage. And this film highlights the human element of Iranians. And I think it's a very, very powerful statement that Iranians will fight for their freedom, that freedom does indeed take courage. Well, let's now hear from the director of the film. Much of this film was filmed in Casablanca. The many of the scenes where the Green Movement was protesting against the regime was, of course, filmed in Casablanca. Let's hear a little bit more of a desert dancer behind the scenes. This is the director, Richard Raymond, on the cross in the desert.
Afshin's story takes place during the Green Movement of 2009, which is when millions of youth were voting in the elections for change. And we all saw it on the news. And when it's widely perceived that the vote was rigged and that the regime that was in power stayed in power, and none of the changes, none of the extra freedoms, little freedoms that the youth were asking for were going to be given to them. What's fascinating about the Iranian youth and how they went about doing that was they're told, you're not allowed to make noise by the police. So they did silent protests. Millions of people protesting silently. They were fiercely intelligent, highly educated. 70% of the population are under the age of 30 or 35. And these are people that are growing up knowing what... All of them have family in America. All of them have family in Europe. They all know what's going on around the world. They are so clever. And yet in their country, the most basic little freedoms that we take for granted are not awarded to them. They're not allowed to go on YouTube. They're not allowed to go on Twitter. They're blocked. So they use proxy servers. They hack in past the firewall that the government sets up and have access to social networking. But those elements can seem quite alien to us, and we can feel quite distant. Oh, that's not our world. But when you start talking about music, and when you start talking about dance, and when you start talking about those things that you were just, why would they be banned? And then you tell a story that's based around that, in that world, the world of the behind closed doors and outside. It was really fascinating. Casablanca in Morocco stood in for Tehran. And, Morocco has a very rich history in filmmaking. All of Ridley Scott's films are shot there. Many films are shot there. Game of Thrones are shot there. And so they have very experienced crews, and they have a very can-do attitude. And we, you know, this film was made, you know, for no money, practically. And the opportunities that we had in Morocco were amazing. So, you know, we put the call out, and so many thousands of people started applying, wanting to be in the film, and that's how we were able to tell the protests with such a powerful force of people, because it had to be real, and I wanted the camera in it. I don't want a crane. I don't want to go wide. I don't want to go, oh, look how big and impressive this is. It's not about that. I wanted people to feel what it was like to be in the middle of a protest and to be there with Afshin and to be this close with him. It's the centerpiece of the film. I had heard about these locations in Morocco where Lawrence of Arabia was filmed, and no one had actually shot down there because it's quite far down, right on the southern border of the country. What people don't know is that you can't really dance on sand because your feet sink. So what we did was we dug a hole, and then we dug a massive hole about 20 meters by 20 meters, and we put wooden boards, and then we put carpet on the wooden boards, and then we put the sand on it again. So at least the surface would be hard when they were dancing. So that was really interesting, but it was still very difficult to dance there. I think the audience, when they see the film, will be left with a sense of unity and hope about what's possible when you do fight for your dreams. I hope it's a very inspiring film. I hope it's a film that people all around the world can connect to, whether they like dance or not. I hope it's a film that people that don't like dance suddenly love dance. And I hope it's a film that people that love dance suddenly go, wow, this is a film actually about dance.
That is the director of Desert Dancer, Richard Raymond. I love what he said there at the end. People that watch this film will learn what it means to fight for your dreams. When I talk to my Iranian friends, they talk about their dreams. They talk about their hopes for the future. They talk about migrating to Germany or to Sweden and to study and to make something of their lives. I talk to my Iranian friends that are graduating or you're becoming doctors who know they can't practice in Iran. This is the wrong place to be. It's so oppressive. It's wrong. But they have to leave their country to look for freedom. So sad. But they are willing to fight for their dreams. Are you willing to fight for your dreams? I know when I watch this film, it's going to be very emotional because I will see Iranians doing what I know they do every day because I talk to them. They fight for their dream. Freedom takes courage, but freedom is worth everything. I want us to hear right now the true freedom. We're talking about freedom of expression today. We're talking about fighting for your dreams. This is a song by Jesus Culture. It's about freedom. Freedom in Christ, the most precious gift we can be given. Here's a song called Freedom Reigns on the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen. the music of Jesus culture. Kim Smith on lead vocals and a song, a powerful song, Freedom Reigns. We have been talking this morning, of course, about freedom for Iranians and the movie Desert Dancer, the fight, the courageous fight for the freedom of expression. The words of Jesus as he began his ministry in Luke chapter 4, quoting from the prophet Isaiah, speaking of freedom, Jesus says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty, that is freedom, to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those that are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness." This is an amazing prophecy that Jesus spoke about when he first began his ministry in Nazareth. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to proclaim captivity," to proclaim freedom, that is, to those that are in captivity. And this is the freedom that Iranians need. We talk about the freedom of expression. We talk about this wonderful ability to speak your mind, to believe what you want, to wear what you want, and that is a freedom. But the ultimate gift of freedom is every thing I do on the cross in the desert to promote the freedom that is found in Christ, the freedom from within, the freedom from guilt and sin, the freedom to be everything God has created them to be. It is a gift from God. And just about 6 months ago, I published my 9th book called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. And I want to read to you a story I wrote in there about my friend Nahid, the precious gift of freedom is the name of it. And since we're talking about Iranians' fight, the courageous fight for freedom today, I thought it would be apropos to read this story called The Precious Gift of Freedom. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free, which Jesus said in John chapter 8, verse 32. In the movie Braveheart, there is an incredible emotional execution scene where William Wallace, the famous Scottish freedom fighter, played by Mel Gibson, is being tortured before a crowd of onlookers. The executioner taunts and begs Wallace to, quote, "submit to the King of England and beg for mercy." Tired and exasperated, Wallace looks up at the executioner and adamantly refuses, and instead gives a death cry toward the audience, yelling, "Freedom! Freedom! Freedom is at the core of who we are as human beings. We fight, we struggle, we speak out for the right to be free." Another famous person of history, Patrick Henry, a statesman and a promoter of the American Revolution, proclaimed, quote, "Give me liberty or give me death." That's how important this seven-letter word is to our existence. I have a precious friend named Nahid who lives in Tehran, Iran, English teacher, and works very hard at instructing children. Recently, I received a very emotional and angry email from her. Like other famous Iranians, she is struggling to survive in a culture of fear and oppression where personal freedom is almost non-existent. My friend laments in an angry and outraged email. She says, quote, "I feel we won't have a free country. I know that we won't. In this country, every single action done by people is monitored by the government. It is ridiculous. We should ask the government's permission if we want to die. I hate, hate, hate this government," end quote. Now, he continues in another outburst of emotional frustration, quote, "I feel we are like animals who are living in a box, and when they need us to grow, they feed us, and when we won't eat, we are imposed to die. I want to shout everywhere. I want all people to know I hate, hate, hate this government." Can you feel? Can you hear the despair and anger and frustration of what my friend is feeling inside every day? In America, government is, quote, "of the people, by the people, and for the people. In Iran, the government is your god, and they control your life from birth to death. How do we respond to this? First, we pray, and then we speak out for their human rights and freedom. This is what I do every day. I have the freedom that Nahid desperately wants, and it's very painful that I can't give it to her. Freedom is a gift from God. God wants everyone to have this freedom, both physically and spiritually. 2,000 years ago, Jesus promised us a freedom we can have when we come to know him as our Lord and Savior. Quote, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free," Jesus promised. Before his death, William Wallace cried out, "Freedom!" We as Americans too often take this precious gift for granted. The next time you pause and pray, please remember my dear friend Nahid. She is desperately longing for what you and I take for granted every single day. Just recently, I had a posting on Facebook about the situation with the nuclear negotiations, and we've all heard about this time and time again. And I asked the question through visuals, "President Obama, are you with the Iranian people? We take our freedom for granted. What's our president doing about it when he sits down with mullahs and knows that the Iranian people are suffering?" A person like Afshin Garafian in 2009 was part of the Green Movement crying out and saying this to President Obama, "Are you with the mullahs or with the people of Iran?" For as long as I live, I will never forget watching the violent and horrifying images of the protests of the presidential election in Tehran in 2009. Police and Basiji chasing protesters on motorcycles and beating them with batons, overturned cars and trash cans on fires, Iranians lying in the streets, their clothes soaked with blood, a sea of Iranian people dressed in green yelling, "Death to the dictator," and the most graphic and frightening image of all, Netta Sultan laying on her back, her eyes widened in shock and blood pouring out from her chest. Perhaps the one image that will forever stay etched in my mind, in the midst of all of the chaos and turmoil, the image of the desperate protesters screaming for freedom and democracy. I can still hear their haunting chant, a question with a plea, quote, "President Obama, are you with the Iranian people or with the mullahs?" Nazra Mohammadi is my dear friend. She is an Iranian-American human rights activist who lives in San Diego, California. She came to America from Iran more than 7 years ago after suffering one of the most painful experiences of her life. Her brother Akbar, a human rights activist and leader of the student movement in Tehran, had finally died in Evin prison as a result of years of torture at the hands of a merciless regime. Nazra retained her brother's prison diary and published it in a powerful book entitled Ideas and Lashes, The Prison Diary of Akbar Mohammadi. I had invited Nazra to be a guest on my radio program, The Cross in the Desert. The first question I asked Nazra was, quote, "When you see President Obama, if you will, sitting across the table negotiating with the Iranian regime that killed your brother Akbar in Evin prison in 2006, do you feel betrayed by your president?" There was a brief moment of silence as Nazra collected her emotions, and then she replied, "Of course I feel betrayed. Yes, unfortunately, he chose not to stand by the oppressed Iranian people." Nazrin's voice cracked with emotion, and then she excitedly proclaimed, "I thought President Obama understood the feeling of being oppressed by being an African-American himself. I thought the history of black slavery would make him feel sympathetic to those people under oppression." Nazrin is exactly right. Racism, the rights of black people, oppression, slavery, the media reminds us almost every day of our, quote, evil white history. Given the facts of history and personal experience, one would think that a President Obama would truly empathize with the Iranian people and would be more than willing to immediately rush to their aid. But, incredibly somehow, nuclear rights have become more important than human rights. But, whoa, wait a minute. When Michael Brown was shot by Darrell Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer, the Obama administration wasted no time in sending the Department of Justice to St. Louis to conduct an immediate investigation. Seems like a huge double standard to me. So race determines human rights. Payman A. Sabet is an Iranian Christian refugee living in exile in Malaysia. I hope one day she becomes an American. She also is a talented journalist and activist for her people. We are great friends. Even though she is a refugee and living in exile, she has not forgotten her people. She periodically writes powerful articles about Iranians and their struggles for human rights. She emails the articles to me, and I read them on my radio program. Recently, I asked her to write an article about the nuclear negotiations. She promptly replied with an emotional letter to President Obama, which read in part, quote, "Mr. President, you are helping the Islamic government in Iran to kill its own people. This nation hoped you would help them restore what President Jimmy Carter did to them 35 years ago that paved the way for the Islamic Revolution. Mr. President, my nation is desperate. They are dying from suffocation, struggling to breathe, and they feel hopeless. They are crying out for human rights while you negotiate for nuclear rights. Every day I'm saddened to hear that more political prisoners have been executed. Desperate Iranians who speak out or disagree with the government are silenced by the noose. Since Rouhani took office as the new president in August of 2013, executions have tripled. More than 1,000 prisoners have been marched to the gallows under his watch. The prison conditions are deplorable, with poisoned food, rampant disease, and continuous abuse and torture. Saeed Abedini, an Iranian-American pastor, and Amir Hekmati, a former Marine and American citizen, languish in prison in Iran while we sit at the negotiating table with the number one sponsor of state terrorism in the world. While Iranians who are naively sympathetic to the cause of their government chant, death to America and death to Israel, Obama administration and John Kerry respond with a warm, cozy, intimate trust to a regime that cannot be trusted. We shake hands and promise relief from sanctions and funnel billions of dollars to a government who will use that money to further their terrorist grip in Yemen and Syria and all over the world, while the people of Iran continue to suffer. Inflation, unemployment, suicide, drug abuse, and no access in part to life-saving medication is the desperate plight of the Iranian people while the government relentlessly pursues their nuclear ambitions. The 2009 election protests are now a part of history, yet many of the protesters are still suffering in prison. The new president, with his charming smile and softer tone of voice compared to his predecessor, is busy deceiving the world with promises of reform, but it's still the same old political game of deception. The negotiations will continue until the June deadline. Iranians will still suffer, and although massive bloody protests in the streets of Tehran are just images from the past, I can still hear the sound, the loud and haunting chant, "President Obama, are you with the people of Iran or with the mullahs?" I think we know the answer to that question. At this time on the cross in the desert, it's my favorite time when I get to read my dear friend Payman A., who lives as an Iranian Christian refugee in Malaysia, I get to read her latest article. Just a couple of weeks ago, it was Mother's Day in Iran, Woman's Day in Iran, and she wrote something very profound about this event. And what I want you to do is set aside, maybe take your glass of tea and sit down. I want you to hear what Payman A. wrote about Women's Day in Iran. I want you to hear this. Some days ago was Woman's and Mother's Day in Iran. Fortunately, women have a special day to be appreciated for all they have done and are doing for their family. Even in celebrating their day, women and men are not considered equal. Woman's Day is not a holiday, but Man's Day is. On that specific day, I was wondering what to say to Iranian women. To say happy what? Congratulations for what? For being a woman? Should I say Happy Woman's Day, while even that day is not specifically based on a Persian woman's birthday? Iranian's Woman's Day is neither a World Woman's Day nor the birth of a Persian woman, but the birthday of Fatima, Prophet Muhammad's daughter, an Arab Muslim woman. Does it make any sense for non-Muslim women in Iran to celebrate it? Haven't they been ignored or disrespected enough? There have been great women during the Persian history, since ancient Persia till now. Madana, the mother of Cyrus the Great, the founder of the first special group schools where she herself taught students law and trained them to stand against cruelty and oppression and be the friend of their subordinates. The faithful Queen Shirin, who had a great role in the history of Persia. Atuza, who was popular not because she was the beautiful mother of a king, but because she was an awesome poet and encouraged education. She was a politician and a brave commander in wars. Utab, who was a great commander and was killed for Persia, as many other women in the ancient Persia in contemporary time, a Persian-Iranian scientist, a women's rights activist, women who fought like male commanders and soldiers to defend their country, Persia. The best scientists and professors in the university and research centers around the world who are making great accomplishments now, but none of them were respectful and valuable enough for the Iranian regime to specify their birthdays as Mother's Day or Women's Day. I was wondering why Persian women should be happy for the birthday of a non-Iranian woman. Why should they celebrate that day? Why should they celebrate Women's Day at all? Because they are women. Should Persian women be happy because they are considered low-class citizens due to their gender? Should they be happy for having no rights or as much rights as half of only a part of a male's body? Should they be happy for not having any rights to select what to wear? Should the educated woman be happy that they cannot get married without their Attic father's permission? Should they be happy for being a woman who cannot have a job, travel abroad, or even visit their parents without their husband's permission? Being a Persian woman means you cannot live your own life. It means you must sacrifice yourself as a sister, as a mother, and as a wife. Being a Persian woman means if your husband is cruel to you and your children, if your husband ruins your life, it is you who must endure because you are a woman. The men must not be blamed because they are men. It means you must sacrifice yourself as a wife and as a mother. Being a Persian woman means if your husband is cruel and considers you his slave, but you want to follow your dreams, it is you who are cruel as a mother and irresponsible as a wife, not your children's father who wants to imprison you in his small dark world. Should a woman be happy of being a woman? A single mother must always choose between her child and future. If she wants to remarry, her ex-father-in-law has the right to separate her child from her. Being divorced or widowed for a single mother means loneliness the rest of her life, no matter how young and talented she is. A woman even has no rights to decide to be a mother or not. She has no right to her own body. If a woman is betrayed by her husband, it is she who must keep quiet and not let others be aware of it. It is he who should finally feel ashamed. But if a woman betrays her husband, a cruel punishment will be waiting for her by family, law, and society, all because she is a woman. When a man abuses or rapes a woman, it is a woman who must shut her mouth because she is considered to have surely done something wrong and attracted that other rapist's attention. Otherwise, if others know about this rape or abuse, the shame will be on her and the rest of her life will be ruined by this society. Being a Persian woman means if your father-in-law ruins your face and blinds you by acid, the only way that you can have your child to live with you is to forgive your father-in-law and do not ask for his punishment. And if he did not do anything to you, as if you were blind and had a deformed face when you were born, as if it was not you who suffered at all, as if it was you, and you're not even a human being. Dear women, please do not be deceived by this sentence. Paradise is under mother's feet. Nothing good is waiting for you in paradise, if there is a paradise. There, in paradise under your feet, your husbands, the fathers of your children, are going to have fun with many, many female angels in front of your eyes. It's better not to enter it. Quote, when I was writing this letter, Payman writes, I found out that a victim of acid attack, whose husband and brother-in-law poured acid on her and her little daughter while they were asleep, died due to their injuries. Brother-in-law was released from prison and kept on threatening the woman's family before she died. The woman is dead now, and her little daughter has not only lost one of her eyes and face for doing nothing wrong, but she also has lost her mother now. The mother who felt her pain and was killed because of being a woman, because of her gender. Just excellent, Payman A. She's putting in perspective this so-called Mother's Day, Woman's Day in Iran. Her point is, you're celebrating the birth of Muhammad's daughter. And it has nothing to do with Persian women. It's all about Arabic women. It's tied in with Islam. So how can you, as a Persian woman, want to celebrate this when you know the meaning of it? And when you look at yourself as being a woman in Iran and that you have no rights, how can you come out publicly and celebrate a day? How hypocritical this is of the regime to come up with this day. When we look in history, Payman A writes, of the great Persian women, they are all ignored on this day. They are not even mentioned on this day. The Islamic regime has done everything to wipe out true Persian history. And so, what is Mother's Day or Women's Day in Iran? Really, what is it? Well, if it's tied into Islam, it's really celebrating the Prophet Muhammad's daughter's birth. But it really isn't celebrating the Persian women. Because as I read to you Payman A's article, I feel that you know what she's trying to say. That it's really an oxymoron. You know what I mean? Woman's Day in Iran. But as we've learned today, by looking at the movie Desert Dancer, we've learned one important phrase. Freedom takes courage. If you want to fight for your dreams, you're just like Afshin Ghaffarian. He risked his life for his dream to become a dancer, despite Iran banning dancing. He didn't just simply submit to their wishes. He simply said, I am an artist. I have a dream. It's in my soul and it's in my heart. And there is no government on this earth that will stop me from realizing my dream. You heard what Nahid wrote in the email to me, how the government monitors every aspect of our life, how she hates the government, but she is not letting it stop her dream. Her dream, Nahid's dream, is to not only be a successful English teacher, but to study abroad and to not let this regime stop her from being happy. She will not let this regime stop her from having true freedom. Afshin Ghaffarian says no. Where he's at today, he is a world-famous dancer living in Paris. He has videos up on the internet, and he has a movie all about his life. He didn't let the regime stop him from realizing his dream. Freedom takes courage. And as we have just read in Payman A's article, the women of Iran are so oppressed, but they have this Women's Day, this Mother's Day. And yet we know that it really isn't celebrating a true woman of Iran, a true Persian woman who is so oppressed. Jesus says, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Jesus is all about freedom, physical and spiritual freedom. Many, many Iranians are looking to Masih, that is Jesus, and finding in Jesus their true hope, their true freedom. It is worth them dying for him. Just like Saeed, who refuses to recant his faith, who says to the guards every day, Jesus loves you, Jesus forgives you. The message of hope and freedom on the lips of Iranians is a force that cannot be conquered. Love overcomes hate. Freedom overcomes bondage. Freedom takes courage, but it can be done. It can be accomplished. And as we've seen here on this video, Desert Dancer, if you have the dream in your heart, nothing in the world can stop that dream. Nothing. My friend Peymane is an Iranian Christian refugee, every day praying and hoping that one day she can leave Malaysia and come into a country where there is true freedom, where she can openly worship Christ without the fear of the Malaysian government that is Islamic or the Iranian government. She wants true freedom, but freedom takes courage, and she has every one of those qualities. I'm thinking of Hamid, good friend, who desires the same hope and freedom. Hamid and Peymane need your prayers. Every day when you pray, I pray that you will think about Hamid and Peymane as refugees. Many, many refugees all over the world desiring freedom, desiring a new life. But freedom takes courage, and freedom is a fight. We don't understand what that fight is all about. We already have the thing that these Iranian refugees are pursuing. So when you pray, remember the women of Iran who want to have a true recognition of what it means to be a woman someday. Think about the refugees all over the world who want to have the ability to stand out in their front yard with their hands raised and saying, I am free. I am free. I am free. Today we've learned about freedom, and we've also learned about what Jesus says about freedom. You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. You can have true physical freedom, but you can still be hopelessly empty and lost. And Jesus says there's something more important than just the physical freedom. It's the freedom from the guilt and the punishment due our sins. I am your freedom. I am your anointing. I am your hope. And so I ask and now pray that you would come to Christ to know this true freedom, to know what it means to embrace Jesus and to have this true freedom. I hope today you've learned about the plight of my Iranian friends. And if you want to be my friend on Facebook, just come to my Facebook page and learn about their plight for freedom. Learn about the Afshins of the world who made their dreams come true because they never gave up. Learn about what my friends have to go through every day. I pray that you will be my Facebook friend and you will learn all about my Iranian friends. It has been a pleasure to speak to you today. I thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to meet with me on the Cross in the Desert. It is a program dedicated to the hope and freedom of all of my Iranian friends. I want to thank Mary. I want to thank Vito. All of you who are faithful listeners, I thank God for you. Thank you for your prayers. Thank you for your support. I want to leave you with a song, again, my open song by Striper, who talks about the truth and freedom we've been speaking about today. God bless you, and I will see you this Thursday again on the Cross in the Desert.
The curse.